Welcome. Hi. Welcome to the encrypted world of Pac-Man, an overview of bootlegging of arcade games in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, how people tried to stop this, and how this stopping got stopped, and people got around it later on. Let me be nice here and introduce myself. My name is Peter, also known as Frankie of the Royal Belgian Beer Squadron Accession and Smash Designs. If you're in the demo scene in real life, I'm project manager and change manager at various companies. I run a blog on arcade gaming and pinballs on gamebunker.be, and I'm also active on Twitter. Pinball Frankie is the personal one, and C64 is pointing out various old school stuff. As well, I fix arcade games in WrestleMania. I am organizer of Revision Demo Party. I broadcast on SceneSat Demo Scene Radio. Otherwise, that's me. So now let's find out who you guys are. This is mostly an arcade topic, so who has an arcade machine at home? Show hands. Welcome, I'm the only one. Who wants one? Has half, okay. All right, so bootlegging, or making illegal copies of arcade games. Why did people bootleg? Well, three main reasons. You have your gray markets, in that, well, people want 5,000 copies of a game. They can only produce 1,000. There's a 4,000 game hole, and this is where the copies come in. Lazy R&D, just change ROM, and you can go from Pac-Man 1 to Pac-Man 2. It can be that easy. And cheap upgrades, say if you have one game but you really want another, then use the same hardware platform, twiggle around a bit with the code, use the same graphics or change a bit, and you have a new game which kind of looks like the one you want. Well, where's the problem? Well, everybody can get an EEPROM burner and start copying the ROM chips. For you, when you want a free game, that's very handy. If your name is Sega or Nintendo, that's very bad news, because that's cutting into your revenue. But as said, we were going to talk about the various bootlegging schemes. So this is this is an interactive presentation, by the way. So which game is this? Come on, shout. All right, Pac-Man. Which game is this? No, it's a different maze, but which game is this? And which game is this? It's not Pac-Man, because it says pre, it's in French. So in the end, you were all wrong, and this is not Pac-Man, but these were Hangleyman, Nupuck X, Nupuck 2, and Scandalman. This is what happens when Namco can only create 1,000 machines a month and the market demand is 50,000. So you had your gray market. By the way, if you ever find the board game is great fun, try it. And all the copies were cheaper too. Now, as we said, these were just your, well, it kind of looks like Pac-Man, and that's your cheap gray market, but as I said, there are three types of bootlegging, which is also the cheap research and development. We have here on the left, we have Joyman, which is completely reworking the graphics. And on the right is Piranha, originally sold as an upgrade board, so you would take the ROM chips of your original Pac-Man and put on another daughter board with other ROM chips, and switch it back on, and then you would have this Piranha game. Most of these were sold as upgrade kits. Mrs. Pac-Man was also an upgrade kit to the original one, but we'll come back to Mrs. Pac-Man later. And for the cheap upgrades, you have one game, a shooter, put in new ROM chips, and you have something that looks like Pac-Man. Actually, this is the only one of all the examples which has the exact Pac-Man maze, although you are limited in colors. Can we guess the game here? It's not Galaga. It's the predecessor. It's Galaxian. Now, just to be sure I'm not kidding with you, this is what Pac-Man actually looks like. But we should get started. So, how can we stop bootlegging? Well, you have your legalese, your hardware, your software, your black blobs of mystery. You can encrypt things. You can have your software commit suicide. You can put in a hardware key, or you can just have faith in the evil spaghetti monster and see what happens. So, legalese. This is you just make up contracts. You are Namco, you created Pac-Man, and you said, well, let's sell it to outside markets, to some other company. Well, hey, Midway, here's our intellectual property. Please give us a bag of money and have fun. Which you end up with the two versions, Pac-Man and then Pac-Man, because Pac-Man, if you go to the cabinet, scrape away a piece of the P, you would have a very bad word in the US market. So this is the legal market, and why doesn't that work? It's interactive, come on, people. Exactly. Andrew actually says that nobody cares. Actually, Midway themselves made bootlegs of Pac-Man, because Namco was too slow in creating an official follow-up of Pac-Man. Midway themselves created Mrs. Pac-Man. They created Super Pac-Man, which are, technically speaking, from a Namco point of view, are strict, cheap R&D bootlegs of the original game. But then, in the end, they kind of made up as Midway got to keep on distributing the Namco games. So that's your lawyers. When you go to the hardware trickery, is the Atari Slapstick, obviously made by Atari. And what the Slapstick does is it switches between memory banks on your ROM chips. It sits on your memory bus, on your CPU bus, and it flips from side to side. If you miss a certain point, when you read something in the wrong time slot, you will read, say, not program data, but graphics data, and your game will crash, or it will just not boot. At the moment, about 15 Slapsticks are known. More could be out there. Some of them got reused, so you can change. They are interchangeable. But then, of course, why did we have the Slapstick? You have to know that arcade games are built on platforms. They would design a piece of hardware with graphics and sound and CPU and use that for 8 to 9 games. Pac-Man itself is on a platform. There are about 4 or 5 games that you can actually swap the ROMs out with Pac-Man. It will perfectly work. Same here for the Atari boards. Say you have a new game coming out, but you have 5 cabinets of the old game. You want the new one. You buy one copy. You buy yourself 4 duplicates of the ROM set. You burn them. You put them in and switch it on. If it wouldn't have been without the Slapstick, you would have been fine. What the Slapstick does is, because it's not a ROM chip, it's actually a piece of silicon which is etched and produced in the factory, your game will not work because the timing is different and your copies will be completely unusable. But we can get around this. As we know the CPU, we know the memory map. You know what's where. You know, okay, this is video data. This is ROM data. You know what is supposed to be where. Because the programming is not encrypted, you can just read your ROM files, dump them, and see what happens when. And once you know that, you can implement that in your own hardware design and get around the Slapstick. It's a bit more effort, but it's still not impossible at all. And actually, it was quite common. Going with the software tricks, these are your methods used on the 80s and 90s, second, third, fourth generation consoles, the NTSC versus PAL regions. What you do is, again, you know your memory of your system, but the memory map of a European system will be slightly different from a Japanese, will be a little bit different from an American. So your NTSC game will try to write something into memory, which it knows that, okay, I'm an American game, I should get an error because I am expecting a room location, not a RAM location. When the error does not come back, it says, well, okay, I'm running on something which is either the wrong region or I am in emulation and I will stop. Not too hard to get around as well. If you set the correct memory locations and emulate it properly with the in software. Going with the black magic and the black blobs, this is a custom CPU found on an arcade board from week 35 of 1986. So pretty old technology already from today's point of view. It's a chip that holds a ROM section, a RAM section, an I/O section, and the programming inside does not travel out on the pins or on the bus. So it's a complete black blob. You don't know what's going on inside, but you need it for the game to actually function. I think you can guess the game. Yes, and if you remember Bubble Bobble coming out really soon, I found it really cool. It's from 1986, so now you're a very old person. Well, so am I, so that's fine. So Bubble Bobble, well, it didn't really help them because Bubble Bobble became Bubble Bobble and Super Bubble Bobble. If you look really careful, they actually just copied the graphic styles from the lower bubble to the upper bubble because they were that lazy in copying the game. But this is how you get stuff through customs, because Bubble Bobble is copyrighted, Bubble Bobble is not, and you could just chip it. So how do you get around this? You use black box reverse engineering. Who is not familiar with that, or wait, who knows what black box reverse engineering is? Okay, for 75% of you who don't, is you take a game and you write a manual. You write a big book, this is how it works. When I put when I put A in memory location B, this is what happens. You write a very big book, a very big manual, and you give that to a second guy. And he takes your manual without looking at the original hardware, the original software, and recreates step by step what you described to get it to run. This happened here on Bubble Bobble, and for that they used the Motorola microcontroller, the 68705. This is the most common bootleg of Bubble Bobble. Thing is that the security chip also holds game code. And so the bootleg has different behavior in the enemies, has different levels, because they had to guess quite a bit. Second method, which was done in the mid-90s, take an original chip, freeze it, take off the cover, put it under an electron microscope, and look at the bits in the section and find out what it is and recreate the code. In the end, Bubble Bobble used an M6801 chip, and who has ever heard of this chip, the 6801? Has everybody ever owned a 1970s American car? Because that was what was in your dials for your speedometer. It's a chip developed for the car industry in 1978. It holds its own ROM, RAM, a timer, and has 31 programmable inputs or outputs. By the time Bubble Bobble came out, 86, the chip was already old and cheap, so that's what they went with. But when you play Bubble Bobble, you actually drive a little bit of an American car around. And we get to encryption, method number 5. You will have a small section in your CPU that holds a decryption key and the algorithm on how to do it. How strong algorithm and your key are define how good your encryption is. If you can quickly decode it, or does it take a lot of effort, or will you never get it? Some algorithms took 15 years or 20 years. We'll come to the point why later. Even not all encryptions have been decoded today. So with today's PCs, of course, getting around it isn't that hard. You just use brute force. And you leave it running with your multi-core, multi-CPU servers leave it running, and in about 3 to 4 days, you have pretty much every key. Certainly, if you check for some magic words, you know, like, you know, Sega, Namco, Nintendo, Midway, those are the words to go for, because those will always be somewhere in a copyright text. You know they should be there. And why it took 15, 20 years is most of these encrypted games got released on home consoles. You got PlayStation releases with, say, the Capcom fighters. You got your Nintendo DS cartridges with your collection of old arcade games from the 80s. And of course, these console releases, they use the original software, they use the original ROMs, and that means you have access to, because the encryption on these consoles is actually weaker than the arcades, you have access to your decryption key, you have access to your algorithm, and you can go from there. Thirdly, every now and then, there was a new version of a game, fixing bugs, adding levels, and for production reasons, whatever, timing or running out of time, most of them, or some of them, were not encrypted. And this would then give you a delta to start from, because you had an encrypted ROM image and you had an unencrypted ROM image. Compare the two, and you went from there, seriously cutting down on your brute force attack. Suicide batteries are an evolution of encryption. The encryption is still there, but instead that ROM and the decipher key and the algorithm are in ROM section of your CPU. They are now backed up in a RAM section with a battery, meaning that when the battery goes dead after 5 years or sometimes 10, if you're lucky, the RAM will be empty and your game will actually kill itself. It will no longer run and you can send it back for repairs. So this is of course good if you are, say, Capcom, because you know, well, I put this Street Fighter 3, 4, whatever, out on the market. I put a battery on it, and I know that this battery has a lifetime of 3 to 4 years. After 4 years, the operator says, well, my game is dead, and he calls you, hey, you sold me something that doesn't work anymore. Oh, that's fine, just send it in for repairs, we can fix it for you for no fee, but you give us Street Fighter 4, we have Street Fighter 5 for you, which we will give you at a discount, at the same time removing the old game from the market, and then also helping your, already then, we are talking 90s now, your console sales. This is, we're in the 90s. That's how that goes. And to get around the suicide batteries is exactly the same method as you would go with encryption, only you have a time limit. You can change the batteries, of course. There are standard 3-volt batteries that you can take your PCB, solder a new one around it, and cut out the old one, or cut out the old one, and you have about 50 minutes before the memory goes empty. So if you can solder quickly and good, you know what you're doing, you can do that. And if you should have a dead game, if you have an unencrypted set, you can sometimes even revive a dead game, because having the ROMs encrypted or non-encrypted won't actually matter for the CPU. It should recognize unencrypted data here. So after suicide batteries, we have the hardware keys. I don't know if these things were popular in Germany, the photoplay games and the touch screens you had in the bars. Okay, they are. Good. Then you know what I'm talking about. Inside, it's a Windows PC with a touchscreen. It's the very cheapest hardware that the Taiwanese and Chinese could deliver, but because they would have to be put out in the millions. Inside of them, you have a normal PC board with a dongle on the parallel port, and your dongle is your security, which will decrypt the hard disk when it's booted and when it's accessed. Now, nobody really cares about these things. You can still get spare parts, you can still get other hard disks and spare dongles, but they are out there if you really want to. They're not even emulated as well. Some are, but most of them not. Why? Because all these silly puzzle games, you now just download them to your phone and you play over there. That's also the reason why you don't see these machines out there anymore. Everybody just plays it for free on their Android or Apple phones. And with the hardware keys, we now come to the fate in the evil spaghetti monster, which is what SNK did for the Neo Geo platform. There is no real copy protection on Neo Geo, but once you get to see a physical game, it's really hard to spot which one is fake and whatnot. Some people say, well, bootlegging killed the platform. I don't agree. The Neo Geo is 2D only. It has absolutely no 3D capability. It does not even have a frame buffer. The video memory is 2 kilobytes because you're just pointing to places on the ROM chip. You can't do 3D. That's what killed Neo Geo, but that's my opinion. So how does this work? You take your game and put a serial number on them. A serial number that's there would match the box, would match the sales record, so they can see, well, okay, this vendor bought this game, and you can keep track of it. A removed serial number does not mean it's a bootleg. If you have a scratched out portion of the label, or it's been cut out, that can be perfectly fine. You can also have holographic labels, which came in later in the platform. And if you see the colors change on your label when you tilt it a bit in the light, you will get an idea if it's real or not. Now, that's because I'm just saying blah, blah here. And, well, you have to work as well here. So let's find the bootleg game. What's wrong with this one? Two people get it. First of all, there are no serial numbers. Second of all, the Chinese really suck at English sometimes. The labels are photocopied, and the yellow cartridge is completely the one color. Most of them are black. For the Korean market, they made some white and blue ones and some red ones as well. But a yellow cartridge simply doesn't exist. And the bottom label is actually completely photocopied and glued on. These are two cartridges I have myself, which I bought off eBay, and they were sold as actual originals to me. So when you look inside the cartridge as well, because you can open them up really easily, this is the same game, so which one is real and which one is not? Left or right? And why? The interactivity is not really there. You can shout, I'll repeat.
The left one is
here. Okay, why? Okay, it doesn't have EEPROMs. It has completely the wrong shape. And the chips should be sequenced. So, okay, that was level 2. Let's have level 3 again. Well, which one is real, which one is not? It's very easy because, well, although we have the PCB correct, we have the shape correct, but as you said, there are way too many EEPROMs on this board. And that's how you figure out the fake. Now, last level, which one is real and which one is not? You're all so quiet. Come on, it can't be that hard. Okay. Oh, actually, the one EEPROM here at the bottom is a real one. If production of the ROM chips couldn't keep up, they would in the factory burn an entire pile of EEPROMs, or when a cartridge got sent back for repairs, it would get repaired with an EEPROM, not with an actual ROM chip. So there are plenty of games out there with actual EEPROMs, and that does not mean that they are fakes. What to look for in this case is they would put little red markers on them from the factory that they would have been replaced. And now for this slide, because there aren't many arcade owners here, I don't know I will get an answer here, but let's try the bonus stage for an extra life. Well. You have Puzzle Bobble, Metal Slug 5, and Metal Slug 2. And each game inside the Neo Geo has two of those boards. One is for code and graphics, and the second one is for music. And that's all for the arcade copy protection, but no. What else is there in arcades? There is always one more thing in an arcade. Next to an arcade game, what do you have? Oh, you have pinball machines. I say, oh, nobody would put copy protection in a pinball machine. Oh, yes, they would. Welcome to the Williams Pinball Controller Security Edition, used from 92 till 95, 96. You have two security components here. In the middle, you have a security chip. This security chip will handle all your signals, your flipper buttons, your coins, your sound, your signals to the display, to the lights. It controls everything. Inside this custom chip, you have a game number. Every game has a type. Say, I think 559 is Medieval Madness. That's what's going to be in the chip. Your ROM chip says, well, I am game type number 559. If these two match, there is no problem, the system will start. When these two are not matching, the game will not start. Meaning that if you have pinball machine one, you cannot take the CPU board of machine one and put it into number two to fix it if it's broken. This will just not work. Now, because the ROMs aren't encrypted, this is just a method that they want to sell more spare parts and more CPU boards to you. If you wonder why pinball machines went away, well, that's one of the reasons, because the operators just got tired of this bullshit. Now, we can fix this as well. This is a PinMame running. It's a pinball software emulator. Because, well, what can we do? Again, the ROMs are unencrypted, so you can go into your old-style Commodore 64 cracking. You hunt down into the code, and when you say, oh, here is the check, does A equal B, you just comment it out, put it on a different chip, and off you go. The security chips can also be changed. They are recreated in FPGA today, and they can be set to hold any game type number that they actually want. Now, of course, when you have a universal serial number in there, which today nobody cares about, you still need a matching game type number and a matching ROM number here. And many of this work was done in the pinball emulation software, just such as PinMame. So that's it today. Where are we now? Because, well, most of the arcade market is dead. You only have the big racers and the big shooting games, which use Windows-based PCs, or they use a Linux system running OpenGL. So what we have today in bootlegging is all these nice and funky Chinese boards, which you can find on eBay and other sites. The 4000 in games have a Chinese Windows 2000 with a MAME on it. The 16-in-1 uses an ARM-based version of MAME with a menu. And then you have the Capcom boards, which will defeat most of your encryption and suicide batteries. So it's still today. Now, are these bootlegs? Well, technically, no. And yes, again, no, because, well, all the arcade games have been out of the market for, well, say 10, 20, 30 years, so the company shouldn't care anymore. But you still have the platforms on the handhelds, on your Nintendo DS, on your PlayStation Network, on your Xbox Live. They will still pop up and make money over there, so people still don't want, well, some companies don't want them in there. Now, honestly, I have had no problem getting these through customs, so I don't think anybody cares at the moment. Some small notes and references. The slides are up for download, so you can go to the sites and read up on the overall data. And I'll now have about 50 minutes left for questions, if somebody has any. Home consoles for suicide batteries? No. No, they will be limited to the region check, but for home consoles, it's okay. Which encryption types in the 80s? not the standards that we know today. It was all algorithms were in-house and developed. It's not that you would come down to your SHA-123 as it is today. It's all made in-house at the companies back then. So that's why it's also, because it's nothing off the shelf, even not in the 80s, you have quite a difficulty finding out the algorithm. That's what part of the difficulty is. Other questions? All right. Then thank you for your time. Thank you for inviting me. I'll be around for the next 2 days if you have any questions or are too shy to ask them here. And thanks for your attention.